Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Brain Sick, a podcast about sick brains, mental illness. This is Andrew Sanford reporting for duty. If you were with us last week on the show, you'll know that Alita was unable to join us, and it was just Lydia and I. And this week, they are both gone. So it is just me today. I hope that's all right. I have prepared a stimulating presentation on two topics. I wanted to talk about hypnosis and meditation today. Both the just scientific literature around them, what they do, how they work, do they do anything, and the relationship between them, perhaps. So we'll just kind of jump right into it on the hypnosis side, because I never ever really thought that hypnosis did anything. It was like a party trick. It seemed like people were always just playing along with it. Like there was like there was it wasn't a real thing such as hypnosis. But it turns out that hypnosis is completely real, according to the science. Putting people into trances, doing hypnotherapy, it can be used to treat anxiety. So I have a lot of studies that I found at the U.S. National Library of Medicine website looking into the efficacy of hypnosis. The first paper I have here is the effect of hypnosis on anxiety in patients with cancer. It's a meta-analysis of 20 papers, and they concluded that the hypnotherapy had a significant immediate effect on anxiety in cancer patients, and the effect was sustained, meaning that when they left the sessions, their anxiety didn't just immediately return to where it was before. There was an overall decrease, and especially, obviously, during the sessions. So it worked. And they found that with kids, it worked better. It worked even better. So placebo or not, it's usable to treat anxiety. And the next study I have here is the effectiveness of hypnosis for pain relief. This is a review of 85 controlled experimental trials with a total of 3,632 participants. And they found a consistent, significant pain-relieving effect of the hypnosis. And this depended largely on two different factors. One being if the hypnosis was specifically trying to relieve the pain. So you could do hypnosis, you could put someone in a trance and just leave them there to distract them from the pain, and you're going to get some kind of effect in and of itself. But if you're hypnotizing the person with suggestions that they're not feeling any pain, then you get a much more significant reduction. And the other factor is the people being hypnotized. It's their innate suggestibility. Their hypnotic suggestibility. And this is where we can also start to kind of talk about the meditation, because there's just this kind of built-in factor of how hypnotizable you are. It's always a voluntary process. If you're going to really be hypnotized, you kind of need to play into it. And obviously the people in all these studies are actively kind of trying to play into it, and they're getting results out of it too. But for some, and probably for some of the people that they studied, you know, the more resistant kinds, it just wouldn't ever work on them. So if you've been hypnotized or someone tried to hypnotize you and it didn't work, it could be that you're just not susceptible, even if you want it to be. Another thing, too, I was watching some lectures by kind of like professional, like private hypnotists, and this one guy, I think his name is David Snyder. He's got like a YouTube channel full of all this stuff. And it's the kind of stuff that you find when you search hypnotism at first. It's a lot of like seducing women and attracting wealth and all this kind of stuff. But he seems very serious about what he's doing. It's very entertaining. This is a very, very interesting world to take a look into. I'll provide links to all that too. But to all of this, all the studies and everything, I'll put a link to the episode notes for this page, which is just going to be links to studies and maybe videos of people talking about hypnosis, just more resources if you want to read more. This is a really kind of like broken down, synthesized look. But he said that a lot of times people that are practicing hypnosis can't perform it outside of a controlled environment. So if you have an office or a studio or somewhere where you're used to doing it, you're comfortable doing it there, you're going to perform a lot better in your safe space than if you are just out on the street or something. A lot of stuff's kind of out of your control. You're not in your element, which makes sense too. And that's the thing, is the only kind of hypnosis I've ever seen are like magician kind of hypnosis, or like the people like the I've seen this thing at least once where they bring someone on the news, like the cable news, to do like hypnosis for like a little like segment. That kind of, and it just looks so fake. And I think a lot of times it is fake, or people are like really playing into it, like a full kind of placebo, like Ouija board kind of a thing. Ouija boards are fake, by the way, folks. They've done studies to trick people. Everyone's moving it. You guys are all just moving the Ouija board. You just don't realize it because there's so many people touching it that it doesn't feel like any one person's, but you guys are all just moving the Ouija board. Okay. Anyways, meditation a minute ago. I did not forget, but we're going to keep it on pause for just a minute. I'm going to get there soon. I have one more study to tie things up right now with the hypnosis, and that is hypnosis for burn wound care, pain and anxiety. And they found a significant difference in pain intensity and in anxiety, favoring people doing hypnotherapy sessions. This just kind of reinforces the trend. I would say the burn wound seems like more chronic pain than the kind of generalized study previously, although that one had a lot of people in it. The interesting thing, though, in this study is that they found that whether or not the people were using medications. So I think in all the other studies, nobody was on medications. And in this one, they found that no matter what, taking the pills or not, it's still better. The increase is still the same. The improvement's still the same. So obviously meds are going to help additionally, and you may need those additionally. But it's still worthwhile to do the hypnosis. So I think one last thing worth mentioning is that all these studies are talking about hypnotherapy administered by a professional, by a practitioner in a clinical setting. And there's other kinds. So there's self-hypnosis, which a few of these studies refer to. They compare clinical versus self-hypnosis, and they say that the self isn't as effective because it's harder to do it yourself. Most people aren't as skilled at just doing it themselves, even if you try to teach them, than like a professional doing it to somebody else. So the idea is, though, maybe you could get to that point where you could be treating your anxiety and your pain with self-hypnosis. You wouldn't even need to go anywhere. There's also conversational hypnosis, which is a lot of like inception stuff, a lot of planting ideas in people's heads and influencing kind of thing. The YouTube man talked about this, and there's another study kind of breaking it down too. Like the reality, it seems there's a science behind this, like social engineering kind of thing. Now we can make the bridge to meditation now, I think, where when I was talking about people being more or less susceptible or just more or less able to be hypnotized or have it work for them. There's another study, too. It'll be in the episode notes, looking into a relationship between meditation and hypnosis, and how this phenomenon, where there might be a spectrum, where on one end people are susceptible to hypnosis, they're suggestible, and on the other end they're inclined to meditation. They're more able to concentrate and actually get into a proper like meditative trance, which is just like such an interesting idea. I didn't even like connect these two different things at all in my head before, but they are really like similar. You know, both hypnosis and meditation are you just sitting down and relaxing. It's a state of relaxation, but it's also a state of concentration and focus in both situations. So the hypnosis is kind of someone taking your attention, and they capture your attention and they kind of pull you, I don't know where, you know, I guess they pull you away from your pain, or they pull you away from your anxiety, and they guide your attention and your consciousness, and they kind of tell you where to go and what to think and how to feel. And in the meditation, you're kind of doing that kind of thing yourself, but you're just like naturally letting your body kind of thermoregulate, balance your chakra. But they both can be used for the same kinds of things. They can both be treated, used as treatments for anxiety and pain and maybe depression. And that's just so interesting that they kind of work in the same levels, and it was really just a spectrum of one or the other, because there's been people have been trying to encourage to do meditation for a while, and I haven't, probably should mention this, I like meditation, I'm a fan of it, I recommend trying it. I have experienced probably over the past like 3 years ago was the first time I started getting involved in meditation and trying to practice it. And it's a slow climb, really trying to build like a habit. And I've just always thought that hypnosis wouldn't work on me, and I was just never interested in it. And maybe it would, you don't know till you try, right? But, I've been always talking to people like, you should try meditation, you should do this. And I've gotten people to try, or at least they have, and they've told me, and you know, a lot of times, probably for me too, the first lot of times you don't get anything out of it. It's hard to meditate. It's hard to build that discipline to kind of just sit still and focus. But maybe if you've tried meditation, or if you've tried hypnosis and they don't work for you, you should try the other thing. That's the big message here, is you should try the other thing, because if one doesn't work for you, the other is probably more likely to work for you. I just think it's really interesting. Let's get into the meditation studies. I hope I haven't been repeating myself, but this has just been a kind of fun discovery for me. So particularly what I'm going to talk about is mindfulness meditation, which I can kind of give a breakdown again, how there's different kinds of hypnosis. There's different kinds of meditation. So the hypnosis that we're talking about is, I don't know exactly how they're doing this, but you know, you're walking in there into a room, you're sitting down with the doctor, and he's got the stopwatch in front of your face or whatever, and he's telling you to fall asleep, and he's telling you that, you know, you don't feel your pain, you don't feel your anxiety, something. And in the mindfulness meditation, what's happening is you're sitting in silence for the most part. There are guided meditations that people have, and if you're interested in getting into it, I've never been a fan of like the guided things. Some people use like the bells, the ball bells. People will put on like music or like a track. I can get into that, but they actually have like apps and other like videos and stuff that is like someone talking to you, walking you through what you're supposed to do and how to breathe and how to put your concentration into the right place and how to relax your body. And you should give that a shot. I think those things are
pretty useful for like learning how to do it. And if you just like it too, that can always be a way to do it. I think I strived to get to a point where I could just do it in silence though, because that stuff was always kind of distracting personally. Anyways, what you're really doing, whether or not someone's kind of walking you through it in real time, is you're just trying to let your mind flow and wander. You try to picture your thoughts, your stream of consciousness as a stream. You let your thoughts come and go. They come down the river and they pass by, and you don't become attached to any one particular thought. You just kind of let your mind cycle. And you don't actively cling or grip on anything. You just sit there and be. You sit there and exist. You're not actively doing anything. You're just letting your mind run idle. And then you're kind of just paying attention to what's coming by. And that's where it can kind of be anxiety reducing and insightful, because maybe you were feeling anxious, but it was kind of like a suppressed anxiety that you just felt so busy and you were doing so many stuffs that you weren't so many stuffs that you weren't even thinking about whatever might have been on your mind that might have been really bothering you. And then you do the meditation, maybe you realize that you had some things that were stressing you out that you kind of tucked away and didn't think about and just kind of put on the back burner, like, I'll worry about that later. But then it starts building up it starts draining your kind of mental resources in the background, and you don't even realize it's there. It's a kind of way of, clearing. It's like restarting your phone. I mean, sleeping's kind of like that too. I think dreaming is too. But the meditation is a useful habit because you're able to do that in real time. You're able to do that while you're awake. It's like you can't. If you're stressed out in the middle of the day and it's like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you can't just like always just take a nap. Like sometimes, if you're at work and you're having a hard day and you get like your 15 minute break, you get your 30 minute break, you can try to squeeze in like a power nap. You can try to do it. I don't know how well it's going to work though, but if you have a 30 minute lunch break and you want to meditate for like 20 minutes of that, you could totally do that. And that'll totally level you out. If that's the kind of thing that you're inclined towards, and if that's the kind of thing that works for you. Alternatively, maybe you can get hypnotized for like 20 minutes during your lunch break, and that would do the trick for you. That it seems less convenient though, that it seems less on demand, because the meditation, you have to work your way there to being able to do it at all. But when you can kind of do it anywhere. And if you could self-hypnotize, I guess you could do it anywhere too. You don't want to do it anywhere, but you could. Okay, let's get into the studies here so I can try to make what I'm saying about the meditation credible. So this study is the role of heart rate variability in mindfulness-based pain relief. So this is kind of running on a presupposition that doing the mindfulness-based meditation is going to reduce pain. And these are the results that they've found and other studies as well. Please look through all the resources that I post. But this one's focused and dialed in on if it's has anything to do with the heart rate. Because when you meditate, and I wonder if when you're hypnotized as well, but when you meditate, your heart rate generally is going to lower. It can lower significantly. You get in a super calm space. Read just from the abstract of the paper again. Mindfulness meditation is a self-regulatory practice premised on sustaining non-reactive awareness of arising sensory events that reliably reduces pain. It's a way of chilling out that hurts less, that reduces pain. Yet the specific analgesic pain relieving mechanisms supporting mindfulness have not been comprehensively disentangled from the potential non-specific factors supporting this technique. So they don't know why it reduces pain. It takes your mind off it. It relaxes you, but they don't understand the exact, biology way that it works. Increased parasympathetic nervous system activity is associated with pain relief, corresponding to a number of cognitive manipulations. However, the relationship between the parasympathetic nervous system and mindfulness-based pain attenuation remains unknown. Their primary study was to look at the heart rate and see if the heart rate was correlated. The results are yes, there is a correlation between the heart rate and the pain unpleasantness, but it does not explain everything. The full study. So 62 healthy volunteers were randomized to a 4-session, about 2 hours total, training program. And they were trained in either mindfulness meditation or they were trained in sham mindfulness, which is described as a breathing-based control. Before and after each group's respective training, participants were administered noxious 49 degrees Celsius and innocuous 35 degrees Celsius heat to the right calf. And then they recorded, all of their pain stats and their heart rate. And the primary analysis revealed that during mindfulness meditation, the higher heart rate decrease was more strongly associated with lower pain unpleasantness when compared to the sham mindfulness meditation. So both the breathing exercise and the mindfulness meditation lowered the heart rate, but the lowered heart rate was more associated with a lower pain unpleasantness than the breathing based control. And I should have mentioned they asked them both for the pain unpleasantness and the pain intensity, which is where things stop looking so clean. Because bigger decrease in the heart rate, lower unpleasantness for the mindfulness meditation compared to the breathing exercise. So this finding is in line with the prediction that mindfulness-based meditation engages distinct mechanisms from the sham mindfulness to reduce pain. However, the same prediction was not confirmed for pain intensity ratings. Secondary analysis determined that mindfulness and sham mindfulness meditation similarly reduced pain ratings, decreased respiration rate. So more mechanistic work is needed to reliably determine the role of parasympathetic activation in mindfulness-based pain relief as compared to other meditative techniques. So I guess what they're saying is that people felt less unpleasant about the pain when they were doing the mindfulness-based meditation. But they didn't say that it hurt any less. They said that it was less unpleasant, if that makes sense. And there was a significant decrease in respiration and all these stuff in both sides. So all in all, there's something particular happening in the nervous system in the mindfulness meditation that doesn't happen in the regular breathing exercise. So if you've done breathing exercises, they're useful, they relax you, they calm you down, but the mindfulness meditation activates more. It does more than just the breathing exercise itself. Although the meditation is really just like a high level breathing exercise. It's a mental exercise and a breathing exercise at the same time. In total, these findings warrant further investigation into the mechanisms engaged by mindfulness as compared to placebo. So there was some effect both ways with just the breathing exercise. And there may be a direct way that just the breathing reduces pain and has a physiological effect. Or there could be some placebo happening in both. And there could be something happening physiologically with the mindfulness meditation. So it's hard to tell from this study exactly how it works, but it's in some way, even if it's just placebo again, like the hypnosis, able to treat these conditions. So if the hypnosis doesn't work for you, you could give the meditation a shot if you're feeling pain. I think that'd actually be a really good idea. I've never meditated to try to relieve pain, but I think it's a really good distraction from whatever's kind of going on around you. Like you're tuning in, but it's relaxing in the way that if I had a pain somewhere in my body, I wouldn't be focusing on it solely. Unless I was meditating and like trying to focus on the pain to like kill the pain or something. I'll pull up another study for us here. This one is talking about for borderline personality disorder, the effects of brief daily mindfulness practice on effective outcomes and correlates in a high BPD trait sample. And what they found was that doing mindfulness meditation, if you have BPD, is good for like the mood regulation and the anxiety and stress and depression and all those kinds of things. I mean, the kinds of like just stressors that you may be particularly vulnerable to if you have borderline. The mindfulness helps you stay regulated and it helps you relax. They make a very, very, very clear point, though, in saying that this is not like all you need. Like if you have borderline, and see, I imagine too, if you in the same way that exercise also helps. So if you're have any kind of like, you know, if you have borderline, if you have bipolar or depression, lots of things, anxiety too. If you exercise, it really helps. If you can build an exercise routine, working up a sweat and getting in motion and moving, exercise releases dopamine. It's like a drug. And I don't know about the hypnosis or the meditation, but building a routine where you're doing all this stuff, as well as a good sleeping habit, a good sleeping schedule, a consistent routine, really helps keep you regulated and keeps your mood good. And your diet also, eating healthy, plus the meditation or maybe the hypnosis. They go to a large length to say that this is not all you need. So if you have BPD, you don't need to just do meditation, then like you're good, like you're fine. Like there's conventional treatment to help manage a condition, and then mindfulness is a good way to stay healthy on top of that. So don't put all your eggs in the meditation or the hypnosis basket. But that's the thing too, you know. So if you are struggling with staying like regulated in your mood and your emotions, you should meditate. You should try it. You should look for apps or videos or friends, or just do it in your dang room and sit on your bed and just relax. I like to meditate with my eyes open most of the time. I kind of go back and forth. But I think I feel more awake and I feel more aware. My awareness is higher when I meditate with my eyes open. And what you're supposed to do, what I do, you can do whatever you want. You're not supposed to do anything. Don't let me tell you what to do. But I like to just sit still. You don't need to have any pose or any kind of a posture or anything like that. You just need to sit still and comfortably. It can be in a chair. It can be cross-legged, whatever you want. Sit still. Set your eyes focused somewhere. If you read like in the Hindu book, in the Bhagavad Gita, it talks about how like a yogi will stare at the tip of his nose and meditate, and he'll just keep his focus stuck on the tip of his nose. And I find that I kind of have to cross my eyes to look at the tip of my nose, so I don't really do that one so often. But just pick a point. Pick like a corner of an object, or pick like a doorknob. It doesn't have to be like pin-sized small. It just has to be a single thing that you're staring on it, and you're not letting your eyes wander, and you're staying concentrated. Or you can do it with your eyes closed as well, and you can just focus on the blankness, focus on the body, focus on the feeling, take the energy out of your eyes and move it towards the body. You may have intimations, kind of like daydream images too, if you're doing that. And I like to go kind of back and forth. Like if I'm meditating, maybe like for like 5 minutes, eyes closed, 5 minutes, eyes open, just like that. I'll kind of like go back and forth. That's the one kind of movement I'll do. It's just how I like to do it. Give it a shot, folks. You might like it. All right. So I think this is the last topic for now. And this study is the alterations in brain structure and amplitude of low frequency after 8 weeks of mindfulness meditation training in meditation naive subjects. So in people that had zero experience with meditating, and they for 2 months, they had them do it regularly. And then they looked for alterations in their brain structure and the wave patterns, the frequencies and everything. To see if there was like a physiological change in their brain and their anatomy and or its function, its electrochemical cycle after just a couple months of meditating. And what they found was, yes, it might actually affect the brain. The brain. And the brain. And yeah, they found that there is a potentially altered depression symptomology and anxiety. So the findings indicate that doing the consistent mindfulness meditation can improve anxiety or depression, and it could make you less susceptible to developing those. So if you were predisposed, if you were vulnerable to developing a depression or an anxiety in response to like a chronic stressor, if you're practicing mindfulness meditation, you're a little bit more prepared, a little bit more able to withstand those stressors in terms of them triggering some kind of dysregulation that you're vulnerable to, whether that be a depressive episode or a panic attack or something. You're less likely to if you're trained to the mindfulness. And it's also something that, again, if you're feeling anxious or depressed, you could actively do the mindfulness. And the direct experience is going to help relieve that in the immediate term. And then the practice over a long term is going to keep you more regulated. I'm just trying to say it's good for you, folks. And not just meditation, everything else in addition to it. It's not a cure-all. And it's probably not going to do much for you if you're just doing it purely by itself. As opposed to if you're trying to, again, like exercise and diet and sleep well and meditate. But it's one of these things that has an effect that's really worth giving a shot if you never have. The science is real. It does not lie. It's not a bunch of baloney. So if you've been putting it off this whole time, now is the time to meditate. It's New Year's resolution in August. It's been real fun, folks. I hope that you've learned something along the way here. I hope I haven't rambled my way all the way out of your attention. I hope you're still listening. The girls will be back next week. It'll be a real romp. But for now, go meditate, folks. Go relax. And I will see you on BrainSickPodcast.com, on Instagram.com/BrainSickPodcast. Check the links for the social media in the episode notes. But visit us on the website and contact us. And, you know, anything, suggestions or just a conversation. Or if you want to buy, pre-order a Radiant Radish t-shirt, we're working on those. They're coming. They look great. Letty is an amazing, talented artist. And you should all buy her t-shirts. And with that, this is Andrew Sanford signing off. Thank you very much. Have a good...